Powers and Shields on the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley, your host, and this is episode 12. I'm joined today by three great panelists, two who've been here before, and one who's a newbie. It's Dr. Drang. Welcome back. Hi.
Hello, you motley mountebanks. Good to be back.
And Erica Ensign, who could not resist the call of a movie with a social conscience. Welcome back.
Apparently, this is my thing. I need to have forgotten men or hobos or something in order to appear.
I hadn't made that connection until this morning when I looked at who was going to be on today. And I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, it came to me about halfway through the movie. I was like, oh, yeah, I guess I have a thing now.
That's funny.
I think I need to be on just a silly romance at some point just to, you know, clear the decks.
We can do that. I'm going to work on some more silly romances. Our friends over at Agents of Smooch might advise me a little bit. But yeah, we'll get to that. And a new member of the LTS panel here for his first time. It is David J. Lohr. Welcome.
Hello there.
So we're going to talk about Sullivan's Travels today, a great movie from Preston Sturges. But before we can do that, we have to do the old movie news. A couple of Blu-rays to tell you about. Interestingly enough, The Lady Eve is out on Blu-ray, another Preston Sturges movie made in the same year as Sullivan's Travels that we'll be talking about shortly. It's a Criterion release, so I'm sure it'll be awesome. Also, Kiss the Blood Off My Hands from Kina Lorber. I don't know much about that except it's Burt Lancaster and Joan Fontaine, and I never heard of it, which always makes me eager to put it on the list. Now, next month on TCM, as we record this, it's mid-July, but this will be out at the end of July, so next month is August. TCM will do its annual Summer Under the Stars marathon, where each of the 31 days features a different star. This year, there are 14 TCM premieres that month and 12 stars that have not previously had a day, which is exciting because the thing is, when they do these segments, I often find them repetitious, and I feel like, you know, in some cases, I mean, there's a lot of the usual suspects, but there are a lot of new ones as well. So I've included not only a link to the official TCM site where this is being discussed, but a Once Upon a Screen blog post, which does a really good job of sort of calling out all of the people who are going to be featured, as well as pointing out the specific ones that are premieres. So I appreciate them doing all that homework for me. And I just wanted to call out a few actors that I think are interesting. Sylvia Sidney, who a lot of people haven't heard of, but she made a number of movies in the 30s and 40s. She worked with Fritz Lang several times. And one of the movies that is featured on her day is a Fritz Lang collaboration called You and Me. She also did Fury with Lang and also Spencer Tracy. And Sylvia Sidney's an interesting actress, had a pretty long career. I think she ended up in some 70s and 80s sort of revival movies where they trotted out older stars and was an interesting character in those movies as well.
Yeah, I think she's known to the young folks as the person, one of the characters in Beetlejuice.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I always forget to look up those specific later references. I think she might have been in Cocoon as well. I'm not certain. Also featured this time around is Nina Falch, who is known as a model and a beauty and sort of an exotic type person, but also quite an interesting, good actress. And she has her own day for the first time. Dolores del Rio, who popped up in a lot of 30s movies. And so there's going to be a lot of pre-code stuff on her day, which should be fun. Diana Dors, somebody that I discovered accidentally a year or so ago. She was a British actress and had been mostly known as a model and sort of a bombshell kind of a person in the 50s. But she's got a catalog that includes some film noir and some interesting British films. Weirdly, and I think it's weird just because I just wouldn't have seen them together. Weirdly, she was once married to Richard Dawson of Family Feud fame.
Whoa.
Weird, huh?
That is a hashtag fun fact right there.
I know. I agree. And finally, Paul Henreid, who is an actor you would have seen in a lot of, you would have seen him in Now Voyager. You would have seen him in a lot of the Warner Brothers gangster films and Bogart films. He made The Scar famously. He also became a fairly prolific director of films and mostly television after his movie career as an actor was over. And I've always thought he was super interesting. And he, for the first time and well overdue, has his day. The premiere movie for him is one called Four Men Only from 1952. Don't know a lot about it. That's what kills me about these premieres. Mostly it means I haven't seen them and I may or may not have the chance to. But there's new movies out there that even I haven't managed to find yet. And now we'll move on to a discussion of our main topic of the day, Sullivan's Travels, a movie from 1941 directed by Preston Sturges. Interestingly, though, Sturges had been around writing Hollywood movies since the early 30s. This is among his earliest directorial efforts. He directed four movies in 1941 and 40 and 41 that would sort of grow to define him, including this movie, The Lady Eve, which I mentioned earlier is newly on Criterion Blu-ray, as well as The Great McGinty. So he kind of started off with a bang as a director, even though he was well known in the industry. It stars Joel McRae and Veronica Lake. I initially thought this was her film debut. It is not. She had a number of small parts in films before that. But this is probably the movie that got her the most attention. And I think, at least in my opinion, she's still kind of figuring out the whole acting thing.
Oh, yeah. Very clearly.
And she hasn't got her hair right yet either.
It's on its way.
That's true.
It's on its way.
That's true as well. It's just working up toward it.
Posters with the Veronica Lake look. The artistic interpretation of the Veronica Lake look. And it's like, that almost never appears in this movie. Wow.
Nope.
No, you have to wait for the Alan Ladd movies for that to happen. So written and directed by Sturges, also starring a lot of what would become the Sturges Stock Film Company. I'll just read a few names. Robert Grieg, Eric Blore. Eric Blore, not so much part of that ensemble, but well known in many movies, mm-hmm. including a lot of Fred and Ginger musicals.
Gosh, I love him so much.
Yeah, Eric, he's great. Not so much in this movie. I mean, it's not that he's bad. It's just that he doesn't have that much of a part in this movie, but he is funny. Mm-hmm. William Demarest, as I like to think of him, Uncle Charlie, Franklin Pangborn, and just a whole bunch of other Preston Sturges stock companies. Feel free to call those out as we go along if they're ones that you are interested in. Anthony Mann was also an assistant director on this film, and I mention that because he directed movies that we have talked about on Lions, Towers, and Shields before, and apparently was quite influenced by being in the Preston Sturges orbit. Also, I have to mention Jess Lee Brooks, who plays the African-American minister later in the movie, not even credited. Not even credited. So Joel McRae was always intended for this part. Sturges wanted him and wrote the picture with him in mind. Barbara Stanwyck, Dr. Drang's favorite, and Frances Farmer were also considered. So if Barbara Stanwyck had gotten that part, you wouldn't be with us. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. that's exactly right. I almost walked out when you started talking about the Lady Eve.
Oh, no! Sturges wrote this film as a counterpoint to what he said were preachy films of the period, which I think is interesting because he has his character name check Frank Capra. Mm-hmm. And so, the movie was released after the United States entered World War II. It was made in 1941 before that happened. And the movie's export license, it wasn't granted an export license because of the brutality of the chain gang scene. And it was believed that the propaganda value that it would provide to our enemies meant that they shouldn't export it.
Hmm.
I'm just going to roll through my trivia, and then I'll quit, and we can talk about the movie. Veronica Lake was 6 months pregnant when production began. When the actual she didn't tell Sturges until she actually showed up to do her part, and he was pretty mad about
that. I bet.
Like, hey, my hair's wrong, and I'm pregnant.
I'm sure Edith Head was not too thrilled either.
No, probably not. They hired a double for her, and Edith Head had to design some costumes around her. Lake apparently was disliked by McRae, who would not work with her again. And there were others on this on the according to Wikipedia, this is. And there were others on this set who did not like her either. It doesn't really describe why. I understand Veronica Lake could be somewhat difficult, but I don't know what the specifics are of that. And finally, just in trivia, the animated sequence late in the film of a Disney cartoon that all the people watch in the church service was a Disney cartoon from 1934 called Playful Pluto.
Yeah, that was a little shocking to me to see suddenly Mickey Mouse's giant face come up, just like living in the world of the litigious Disney Corporation as we do. I was like, how can you put Disney in here?
Well, yeah, it seems like there would be some licensing issues. This is definitely
Paramount.
I mean,
it is licensed. They make sure to show the trademark at the beginning of the cartoon. Mm-hmm. And apparently they had originally contracted with Warner Brothers to do an animated opening, which God knows if they ever even bothered making it because they didn't use it. And I wonder if they were intending to also use a Warner Brothers cartoon and something happened. I don't know. But I know Disney was looking for money at that point. So, you know, they had...
Yeah, I did read that they wanted to use a Chaplin short, I think,
That too, yeah.
During the movie sequence at the end, movie night sequence at the end, and Chaplin, he wouldn't let them.
And he wouldn't let them.
It is amazing that Disney allowed this back at the time, but as David said, you know, they had some ups and downs with money.
Yeah, they were pretty hungry at that point.
Well, they had just had Pinocchio and Dumbo, which were not doing well at the box office, and they were struggling for money. I mean, they were taking contracts to make government films. So at that point, I can see them licensing. Mm-hmm. 10, 15 years later, not so much.
So just, I guess, quickly, just to put this movie in perspective, it very much had mixed responses when it came out. The New York Times liked it, but a lot of others did not. It seems to have had fairly good support from its studio folks, though, even though it pokes fun at the movies, but it does so in a way that is not as aggressively anti-movie, in a way that people who are looking at it on a surface level might be able to suss it out. I think the actual comedy aspects of it probably won people over, but apparently Sturgis did have a fair bit of support from the studio, which he didn't always have later in his fairly short career as a director.
Yeah, well, part of that is because he's sort of taking a stance against pain-in-the-ass directors in this. So, you know, that's the what he ends up doing, what Sullivan ends up doing, is basically falling back to what the studio had told him at the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm. It's very true, and which is why the ending is sort of makes you shrug your shoulders a little bit. And uh-huh. What was the point? Why did we do all this? So I thought we would talk about this movie in sections. Feel free to add, deviate, jump around as you like. But rather than do a full-on plot recitation, because it does kind of fall into sections. And we begin by meeting our main character, John L. Sullivan, played by Joel McRae, who is a very successful film director. They're screening his latest picture, and his studio bosses are happy with his work. They want him to make a comedy, but he wants to make a message picture called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? From a fictional novel of the same name. And it is important to note here that the Coen brothers, when they made that movie eventually, were very much influenced by this movie and Sturgis in general.
I was going to say, several years ago, the music venue here in town that I work with, we put together a concert of the music from Oh Brother, and they realized it was very depressing if you just played the music, because they're all really dark songs. And they said, can you give us a framework? Can you make it light and funny? So I built a framework for them as if it were a radio show based on the movie made by Sullivan of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And there were all these people like, what are you talking about? And so we wound up explaining this little cinema in-joke. And it was delightful. It was great fun to sort of weave those together.
That's great. I have the soundtrack to Oh Brother. And even though I'm a folk music fan, you're right. It can be very dour if you just listen to it by itself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the happiest song in there is like, You Are My Sunshine. But most of them are like, oh, we're all going to die. Life sucks. Going to die.
So Sullivan here is a very earnest guy, and he's tired of all these comedic successes, including Ants in Your Plants of 1939, which is a lovely title, and Hay in the Hayloft or something like that.
Hay in the Hayloft.
Hay in the Hayloft. Right.
Hay. Babu Frick.
Obviously. And so he wants to make a message picture, and of course his studio bosses were like, no, we don't want you to do that, and even if you do make it, could you make sure there's some sex in it? But Sullivan would like to see capital and labor destroy each other, which is my favorite line from that.
With a little sex.
Right. I just don't want to stress it.
And they call him a communist, because why wouldn't you? But that's the thing, like they spend so little time with the studio heads that it's not going to be one of those pictures where they are breathing down his neck for the whole time, because this movie isn't really about him making this movie. It's a very perfunctory, there's a conflict between the two of them. But somehow I get the impression that he would get to make some version of the movie he wanted had he not decided to go off on this grand adventure.
Yeah, this opening scene, the scene in the studio heads, it's not exactly the opening scene because they start off with, you know, them screening his movie, but
the end.
Yeah, it's Citizen Kane, right? You know, we're seeing another movie within the movie.
Yeah.
But as they walk out of the screening room and into the studio head's office, Robert Warwick's office, it is, I believe, one continuous shot that lasts a really long time. and it is sparkling. The dialogue in here, this is why I love this movie, is this,
yeah,
this
it's great.
First
it's
scene,
tremendous.
You know, but with a little sex in it. Yes, with a little sex in it. And
and as a running line, too. That's not just one joke.
Yes, exactly.
It's so beautiful.
It died in Pittsburgh. Well, what do they know in Pittsburgh? They know what they like. If they knew what they like, they wouldn't live in Pittsburgh.
Ouch. Right. I mean,
and it's Warwick and Porter Hall, also in the Sturgis Stock Company.
Repertory, yeah.
Essentially, you know, ganging up on Joel McRae, and just back and forth between the three of them. Bing, 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 bing. Very well done. The camera doesn't move a lot, but it does move as they're going around through this. There's not. I think Warwick has a little bit of a stumble in one bit of dialogue as they're nearing the end, but it's handled well, and they just kind of, and they push through it. It's really just a great scene, and sets up the whole movie, including, you know, the part fundamentally. You know, he wants to make this movie that's deep and important and you know, tells the real situation. And they convince him, well, you don't know anything about real life. You're a college boy and a prep boy, and you've been making movies ever since you were 20 years old or whatever. And you don't know anything about the school of hard knocks. You're not like us. And apparently, it turns out that, of course, they're lying about their difficult time.
Yeah, they tell all these great stories about what terrible childhoods they have, which all turn out to be lies.
We realize after Sullivan has left, and the thing is, ultimately, and I'll let you get back to the Shelley in a minute, but in a second, this all backfires on them because wants to make this movie. They convince him he doesn't know anything about being poor, but that puts a bug in his ear. And he gets the idea, well, I'll go out on the road and find out what it's like to be poor. And that's the rest of the movie.
And the beautiful thing about it is he lays out the ending in this opening scene where they say, you want to make something like Capra? You want to do that kind of thing? And he's, yes, I want to show the darkness, and I want to hold up a mirror to reality, but with a little sex. Yes, with a little sex. And then they say, you know, because he's saying it's a dark world out there. And they literally say, maybe people want to forget about it for a while. Maybe they want entertainment. Maybe that's what gives them something to hope for, right? And he just goes, he breezes right past that because he really wants to make this movie. And, you know, as soon as I heard that line the second time I watched it, I was like, oh, he set it all up right there. That's the movie.
So you can just watch that first scene and be done. I will agree that everything they were they did it very well, but I didn't like it. None of it worked for me. I think I'm pretty sure I had seen this movie before, but I'm not sure I had ever seen it from the very beginning. And I did not remember how madcap and just sort of frantic the pace was. And like, there's not a lot of slapstick in this scene, but there's more there as we go on. And I think I just wasn't expecting it to be quite so amped up, and I wasn't ready for it. So while I like everybody did a great job, you know, of not stepping on each other's lines and being able to, you can understand them, and they were fast, and yeah, that opening shot is great. But I was just like, oh wow, when is Veronica Lake going to come and save me?
It's really interesting how it does. It's 90 minutes, and it really breaks down into three short films almost. Where the first one is like straight up slapstick, fast talking banter. Mm-hmm. The second is basically romantic comedy. And the third is pretty serious when he finally gets his wish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just feel like the first movie of these three was not particularly for me. But I do feel like it's pretty good at setting out, you know, what it's... I think part of it, too, is he's setting out what he decides to do at the end of that. Like, I'm going to go and try to see what it means to be poor. And the whole idea of class tourism is really icky. And I feel like, you know, this movie definitely wrestles with that. It grapples with it a little bit, but I don't feel like it actually grapples with it enough. Like it
doesn't do it enough. Uh-uh. Like the butler who argues with him about it, then goes along with it once Veronica Lake is involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was kind of weird.
Right. Because the butler speech initially, see that to me sums up the way this is complicated and the way people should think about this beyond just, oh, isn't it neat that he's going to have this madcap adventure? And you sort of think at the very beginning, when it's just him and the film studio guys, that it's going to be sort of a classic independent director is being stifled by the studio and he'll show them and he's right and they're bad and they're wrong. But the butler, when he comes in and basically explains why class tourism is a bad idea and why he is, you know, misapprehending the poor people he wants to observe, that sort of explains the better explains it better from a political point of view. Although, as you say, he does go along with it, and Joel McRae doesn't listen to him.
And
it,
I mean, I wrote down so many quotes this time because it's, I mean, Sturgis, come on. And one of the butler's lines right there is, "The poor know all about poverty, and only the morbid rich would find this topic glamorous." Mm-hmm. And it's
so
just
good.
There's so many wonderful little punctures all along for all the, like, nobody in this movie comes off scot-free, really. You know, everybody's hypocrisy is punctured at some point.
Also, in terms of the way the movie is made, because that opening scene of his movie that they are showing in the screening room, and then subsequently the slapstick scenes like the car racing and them playing in the being knocked in the pool and all that stuff, those are all movie tropes.
Yep.
Those are all to make this movie more visually, you know, oh, it's an action sequence. Oh, it's a slapstick sequence.
There's always a girl, and she only has the name The Girl.
Yeah.
The Girl. She has no name.
Right? Which, but
funny.
That's,
yeah,
but
that's
I get that. Mm-hmm. I get that.
That's the point.
Yeah.
It's the point.
Totally.
Right. It's again, pointing out the hypocrisy of other films, as opposed to him saying, hey, this is what I think of her.
Right.
Although he may have thought that about Veronica Lake afterwards. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So he goes home to begin his adventure. He gets some old clothes. His butler gives him this speech about class tourism, suggests perhaps he shouldn't do it.
We have Chekhov's ID card.
Yep.
Yes, indeed. We have an ID card sewn into the bottom of the heel of his shoe so that if he's ever found, we know whose ID card belongs to. Thanks, butler. we also this is at the point where it's not actually all that important in the movie, but just as a name, he has a wife, an ex-wife, except she's not quite ex, and they don't get along, and he has to pay her a bunch of money, and it's a bad relationship, and I suppose that would potentially have been a roadblock for him and girl.
And she won't give him a divorce.
Just a, mm-hmm.
And I felt like that it worked kind of nicely to make it so that you aren't reading too much into the later scenes with Veronica Lake and Joel McRae. Like, he's a married man, so why would we even think that, you know, anything, any hanky-panky could be going on between them during their travels and stuff. So it's handy that he has a wife.
I just love the sensibilities of even post-code, where you're trying to inoculate people against the idea that they might, that some people might be having sex by, oh, well, he has a wife who's not even his wife in name, well, except in name, because they don't live together.
Or ever,
and
maybe.
I loved the sort of nod to when she's talking about her film career and that she didn't get anywhere with it. But, you know, she never had breakfast with any of these directors. But maybe I'd be doing better if I had. And he says, did you? And she goes, no. And so it's like, there's only one thing that means, but it's very sly, mm-hmm. the way he puts it across.
Yeah. Yeah. So he goes out in his rags to make his way in the world as a hobo, or apparently some of the production code people had trouble with the word bum. So the word tramp is used a lot. I can't remember if they say hobo or not, but tramp is what William Demarest says later. So he starts walking and there's a bus full of studio hangers on. This is where most of the stock company is, William Demarest and his team of, I don't know quite what everybody's job is other than to look out for
Joel
McRae.
PR and doctor and chef and reporters. And the driver,
the
and the bodyguard, the photographer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I kind of watched this, and my one of my sons was looking and was like, this is like their version of The Real World or The Truman Show. And it's like, well, kind of, right? It's this reality thing following him and trying to make it look like he's doing his own thing and he's realistically a hobo. And yet he's being followed very slowly by the land yacht.
Yes, I love that term.
Yeah, I'd always heard it in reference to very large cars of a much later period, but I took note that this is probably the earliest cultural reference I've heard that term. So next we get a nice set piece where he gets a ride in a car that goes really fast. There's a chase. Again, nice movie trope. Let's stop our serious/comedy movie about ideals to have a nice car chase.
I was bored.
Yeah, that scene, I mean, apart from, what is her name, Margaret Hayes' legs, which are great.
and rather impressive for the time.
Absolutely. And there's absolutely, that is the reason she is flying around in the cab of that bus, is to show off her legs. But yeah, otherwise, I don't like William Demarest in that scene. I don't, you know, the cook is treated very badly.
Yeah,
it doesn't last too long, fortunately.
Mm-hmm. No,
I mean it's a little longer than it needed to be.
It feels like it's
yeah.
But it definitely feels like it's put in place in that place for a reason that has nothing to do with the plot.
And it's clearly cranked up, and he's already made a reference to Keystone Cops kind of movies early on, mm-hmm. and so this is your Keystone Cops sequence.
We're seeing one of his movies.
Yeah,
basically.
In this thing, yes.
So Joel McRae gets the bus full of people off his back with promises that he'll meet up with them later. He goes to work on a farm. We get to see him shirtless. The two old ladies are, the two ladies there are kind of creeping him out, so he leaves. He can't, in all of his travels, he can't get away from Hollywood. He ends up, he hitchhikes and he gets out of the truck and he's like, where are you? Where am I? I'm in Hollywood. So the poor guy can't even get himself out of town.
One of the things at the farm, I mean, yeah, the women are creeping him out. Why wasn't he creeped out by the portrait of the woman's dead husband whose expression kept changing in relation to whatever he was doing? That was great, but that was, yeah.
Yeah, and he's wearing the clothes that are in the
picture.
He's wearing that suit.
Right.
It's very Scooby-Doo, but
it's
in a good
way. It's in the
photo.
Yeah, and when he's climbing out the window, I watched it while my spouse Steven was in the room. This is not his favorite era of film, but he was kind of half paying attention. He's like, this is Bugs Bunny music. Like, he was paying attention mm-hmm. to the music more than anything else. And I was just like, well, yeah, this is, you know, a heisty sort of like, you know, we're sneaking around kind of music at the time in the 1940s. That's what it was.
Claws for alarm. Mm-hmm.
The surprising thing is that the nail didn't take his pants off.
Mm-hmm. I was waiting
frankly,
for that.
I mean, because there's a lot of beefcake in this movie. Mm-hmm. And
And there's all that ripping sounds. Yeah. And you're thinking he's going to come away without any
I
pants on
I thought we were
going to
see, you know, his muscular thighs here. And it didn't happen.
Nope.
But, you know, we get the torso a lot.
Quite a bit.
Joel McRae.
Yes. So now we get to meet Veronica Lake. Are you happy about that, Erica?
Finally.
Here comes Veronica Lake.
She very much brought the energy of the film down like three notches at least, which for me was a good thing. I'm not sure everybody necessarily agrees with that, but
this is literally one of those splits where we are now in a totally different film.
Yep.
And that makes sense.
Yes.
It's again, you know, it's like you have your it even kind of matches the eras of film, right? You've got your silent wacky comedy action. You've got your 30s style Howard Hawks kind of bantering, and eventually you'll get that Paul Muni fugitive from a chain gang thing.
Although at some point we're going to get a silent montage in the middle. Yeah. I'm not sure quite why it fits
yeah,
where it
weird.
Is, but
I guess it's to show all those things without actually having to like put dialogue to them and bring the mood down.
Yeah, it's kind of fast-forwarding. Although there are an incredible number of extras
in
that segment, which is...
Yes.
So Veronica Lake is down on her luck. She's leaving Hollywood because she didn't get very far. And for some reason, Joel McRae's answer to all this is, let's go back to my house, not so that I can mac on you, but so that I can give you a good meal. We'll go get this guy's car,
guy
who I know. And so,
yeah,
it's a guy I know. And very quickly, he's back in his fancy car and you know, the house. And it's just like, wait, how, those ideals you had a minute and a half ago, what happened to them? And it's not because he's smitten with Veronica Lake. He more feels sorry for her.
And she did buy him the meal in the first place. So I think it was interesting because it's almost like he's a little bit upset. Like, I'm setting out to do this thing and be this poor person, and somebody's taking pity on me. And there's this disconnect in his brain because he's not a person who needs somebody to take take pity on him because he's actually this super, super rich guy with, you know, a pool and a horse or whatever, all that stuff. And somebody who can't even afford it is now buying him a meal. And that just sort of offends his sensibilities enough that he's willing to put his whole scheme on hold to make sure that she is taken care of. It's very much white knight syndrome going on. And that's how it all sort of gets started.
And it's great how, again, I mean, Sturgis keeps puncturing things and flipping things you expect. And, you know, this is a line you don't expect in a 1941 movie where she says, you know, the nice thing about buying a man food, you don't have to laugh at his jokes. And it's such a wonderful line. And she actually gives the touchstone for the next part of the film by saying she wants to meet Lubitsch. That's the director she wants to work with. And, you know, we're slipping into a Lubitsch film now.
Lubitsch territory, yes, very much so. So there's some shenanigans with them getting arrested briefly, and then we go back to his house. I sort of ignored that part, not because I didn't like it, but because it very much feels like, well, we have to put our characters in some sort of comedic peril, and so that happens. Then we get back to the mansion, and they both fall in the pool. There's some more slapstick there. It just feels like this whole section. It's like romantic comedy without a lot of romance. And they're not bantering in the same way at all that he bantered mm-hmm. with his studio executive friend. She does have great lines. You're right, and you quoted some of them. But they don't really engage in couple banter the way you would expect in a lot of romantic
comedies. Right. This is more, it's almost Aaron Sorkin-like in its sort of, we're gonna give a little character and a little exposition, but we're not actually going to let the characters connect.
Right. Because he all this time has said, I'm going to buy you a train ticket and you're going to go home. Because he wants to get back on his adventure, but mainly he wants to see her well off, well taken care of. And she doesn't want to go. She wants to go with him because she's actually becoming attracted to him at this point.
Yes. Take me with you on your experiment. You need me.
Yes. Whatever that experiment may be. I don't think she really conceptualizes what he wants to do. It's not that she is critical of it or that she likes the idea. I think she just wants to go with him. And whatever he was going to do, she probably was going to be happy to do. She doesn't really have anything waiting for her mm-hmm. wherever
and
home
she's
is.
Already figured out that he's helpless.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, he may be rich, but he goes out there with 10 cents. He's going to die.
This was one part that I was a little bit disappointed in is that like it starts off with her saying, you need me because you don't know anything about being in trouble. You don't know how to get a meal. You don't know how to blah, 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 all of these things. And I'm like, OK, cool. This is a great dynamic. I look forward to her helping him out and setting him straight as he goes along his path. And that never pays off in like any way whatsoever. They are evenly matched in terms of what they know and don't know about what it is to be on the road like this. And I was just kind of like, so not only does she not have a name, she doesn't have any of the expertise that we were led to believe she was going to at the beginning.
Yeah, it is true.
It's really true.
I've seen this movie, I remember the first time I saw it, which was 40 some years ago. Yes. Why isn't she the one who's taking him under his wing and saying, look, dummy, here's how you do this? And, you know, sort of like It Happened One Night, where Claudette Colbert shows Clark Gable how to flag down a car for hitchhiking.
Again, mm-hmm. good use of legs.
Yeah. So, you know, but we don't see that. And I don't know whether Sturgis thought that's what we're going to do. And then, no, I'm going to switch it up on them. Because that's what they're expecting, or it just was never part of the plot at all. I don't know, but it is something. Eric is exactly right. This is what you think. You're led to think she's going to be the wisecracking, smart, street smart kid who teaches him how to do things, and it doesn't happen.
And it could have been something that changed as he was getting to know her style, or as he was getting to try and not be furious with her. That he was like, you know what, I'm going to change this.
Yeah.
Who knows? Because he did rewrite a lot when he was filming. So.
Yeah, well, and I wonder, too, whether it might have had something to do with Veronica Lake. Maybe she didn't show what he needed in terms of comedy chops. Maybe she bantering was not something she was good
she
at.
She does pretty well in the diner scene where she's bitter.
Yes.
And she delivers those lines.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought really well. But yeah, whatever. They did whether it's because he didn't want to do it, Sturgis didn't want to go off into that Claudette Colbert sort of way, or as David suggests, maybe he just realized he couldn't do it with her. Don't know.
So they eventually end up on a freight train after his butler has called to find out when the next freight train is leaving and where, if one wanted to board one, one might do
that. Does your train carry tramps?
Do tramps get to ride, right. And where would they board?
So good.
Where do they board?
Which, that's one of my favorite lines for him. It's just,
I love it. I love it.
And then the limo drives to the rail yard. To drop them off.
Yeah, it's not enough that he's in a convertible before when he went back home to get his car to take Veronica Lake to the mansion. Now they're in the back of a limo being driven to the. And I forget what. Right.
Yeah, it's no wonder that none of the other tramps help them get on the train because they're just like, who are these people that just got out of a limo? I wouldn't trust them either.
Exactly. And no, not unless you're going to roll them.
And again,
or something.
Veronica gets to reiterate the theme of the movie where he's, you know, she's like, well, what did you direct? And he's like, oh, did you like ants in your plants? She goes, no, I didn't like that. Musicals hurt my ears. What about Hey, Hey in the Hayloft? She's like, oh, I like that. That's a comedy. I love comedies. People love comedies. And so again, he's just sort of layering that in there.
Yeah, it's pretty thick.
Hypnotizing you.
No, I was not hypnotized. I was rolling my eyes.
Oh, I was rolling my eyes too.
So they spend the night on the train. It doesn't go very well. They're cold. They have allergies. Apparently, they're smelling pigs. So it doesn't go so well. They get off the train to go have coffee. But oops, he's lost the dime that he had. So no coffee for. Well, he get the proprietor of the diner takes pity on them and gives them the coffee
and donuts.
And now they're in Las Vegas, which is where they were supposed to meet the bus.
Which just happens to be right outside the window.
I know. I thought that was pretty weird. Yeah, well, Vegas, I know it was a smaller town in 1941, but this is ridiculous.
Oh, very much so. There was almost nothing there. There were no casinos. Although I'm amused by the line, you know, what do you do in Vegas? It's an education. Everything happens in Vegas.
That is funny.
And it's like, but there was nothing there then. Oh, okay. He was psychic.
So now they've all taken off from Vegas. I was sort of unclear about the doctor. He is apparently sick, whatever that means. I guess he had a bad cold, but the doctor puts him to bed for several days. Apparently, he was a lot more sick than Veronica Lake because she was up and around and walking around and visiting him and stuff. So I guess he's even more tender than he seemed.
Very true. Yeah. So then they get to basically, you know, she gets to have a shower and put on makeup and then, you know, put on a wrap that looks very much like the dress in the posters. And
Edith had designed to conceal her belly, I guess.
And again, a fairly racy shower for 1941. Yeah. Although I realized later that was to contrast with the sort of communal hobo shower we see later.
Yep.
So it's like, oh, here's a very glamorous shower.
Yeah, that land yacht was like nicer than my apartment. So I was jealous. Like, I would take that trip, thank you.
Well, so now we come to the montage of this movie, and it's actually several montage pieces put together. It's quite long.
It's really long, yeah.
It seems long, and I always think it's going to end, and it doesn't. So what thoughts on the montage? And again, no dialogue at all. It's not silent. There's a score and a lot of extras. And this is the continuation of their journey and his presumably completing his mission or the first part of his mission.
Yeah, this is his successful foray into the world of tramps. For lack of a better word. And we have, there's a soup kitchen, there are the communal showers, there's the rescue mission house, there's the sleeping on the floor where his shoes get stolen. That's also matters
we'll need
later
that for
on.
Later.
And it does go on a long time, and they're walking through the hobo jungle areas, and it ends with them in an alley looking through trash for food, presumably. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of look at each other and say, you know, well, they don't say anything, but what passes between their eyes is, you know, I think we've done this. Let's go. Mm-hmm. And
vacation over.
Yeah, yep. Exactly.
I got to say, Hobo Jungle was one of the worst Disneyland ideas they had. Fortunately, they didn't do it because, you know, morbid original.
Yeah, I was surprised by this. I guess, did I just see bits and pieces of this movie? I don't know. I was not expecting this. I mean, maybe I just watched the romantic comedy chunk and then turned it off. I don't know. Or blocked it out. I didn't mind the montage. I thought it was kind of a smart move because I don't know that after the, you know, sort of screwball comedy of the first part and the romantic comedy of the second part, I feel like it would have, if we watched all of that actually happen with dialogue played out for as long as you would need to play out each one of those little chunks of scenes, I really feel like it would have run the film to a grinding halt and just felt like a complete mismatch in terms of tone. I still felt like it threw me a little bit. It was just kind of like suddenly we threw on the brakes and everything, you know, took a sharp left turn and everything was a little bit different, but it was less whiplash than it would have been to, I think, go through all of that. Also, it would have made a much longer
movie. And to do that straight with dialogue would have turned it into the kind of movie he wants to make. And that's not the movie you want to see.
Yes.
Some of us might. That's not the movie Preston Sturges wants to show us.
I love the message of the movie. I love the lesson that he teaches by the end of it. It's not my favorite Preston Sturges film because my mind tends to wander. Whereas, you know, Lady Eve or Palm Beach Story, I am just paying attention the whole time.
Yeah, whereas I was left feeling really uncomfortable about the message and the idea that, oh, you know, I've been through all of this awful stuff and now I understand what it's like. So rather than doing anything to change it, except for handing out a few $5 bills here and there, I'm just going to go and make some comedies. That's how I'm going to make the world better.
It's muddled, but the best way I could characterize it is that he's not equipped to be the messenger. Like, he's learned something, but instead of learning something and becoming the perfect filmmaker, he's like, you know what? I am a comedy director.
Stay in my lane.
Well, he has not learned his lesson yet.
No, not at this point.
Not yet. He hasn't. And I think the silent montage thing is important because it is, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? You know, it's the movie he wanted to make. And seen in, I think, a very compact, you know, it goes on, but it's by not having dialogue, I think it moves along more quickly. I think the fact that you don't expect this to happen in the movie and you're kind of wondering you're expecting something different. And then, you know, finally it does end. But, I think it's important to establish, for the purposes of the movie, that there's the awful part of being poor, the sadistic part where people are sadistic to you of being poor, and then there is the awful part that's just because you're poor, and that's this part. Mm-hmm. Then we get to the sadistic part later on, and I think it's important to Sturges to show both of them.
I think this part also establishes their relationship a little bit more firmly.
Because they go
through this together.
Exactly.
You know, maybe the length of it, maybe the amount of it is that he's like, you know, she can handle the banter in the diner scene. Maybe she can't handle the serious part. Maybe we'll just do it with music. I don't know.
And I think Erica's right that it would have been too earnest for the movie and too long if they had done this with dialogue and scenes. I think they either had to skip it or they either had to do something like the montage. And I quibble with the length of it. And I'm just not a fan of long parts of movies without dialogue. That's just a personal preference thing of mine. But it did occur to me while I was watching it, what we're doing is seeing the passage of time, and we're seeing that they're having these experiences that they need to have, because the next scene, he's going to be in silk pajamas in his house. So you have to have had something happen, even if it's not him learning his lesson yet. He thinks he's done because he's done what he set out to do, and he thinks he's learned his lesson, and now they're chilling at the crib.
One of the things he says point blank right at the beginning, and he says this a couple of times, is, you know, I want to go out there where I have no friends, no support, nobody watching out for me. You know, I don't want anybody to know who I am or where I am. And he's still, even though he's managed to pull away from the protectors and everything, that by this point, he still hasn't actually had that yet.
Right, because of that last scene when they're looking through the trash, they get to decide, Okay, we've had enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. It's
and they're
their
doing
choice.
It together.
Yes. Vacation over. So he's back home, and he wants to go and give back to the people he met along the road. So he's going to go somewhere random and hand $5 bills out. Well, that doesn't go very well.
It's only a little patronizing.
He gets knocked out. Yeah, a little bit. A little bit. And for his trouble, he gets knocked out. He gets rolled. They back at home are wondering where he is. When we finally see, I love the scene on the train tracks because that harkens back to every, it's not that I've watched a lot of silent movies, but I've seen a lot of referential remembrances of silent movies where the damsel, the heroine is stuck on the train tracks and the train is about to run her down. And when I see him on the train tracks, it's exactly what I think of. It's hilarious. So again, movie tropes for you. So they're wondering where he is. Eventually he pops up. He's in a freight yard and he mouths off to a railroad bull because he doesn't know any better. And he slugs him and he gets arrested and he gets thrown in jail. And he's Richard Rowe, which is apparently a sort of a John Doe type name. Maybe Frank Capra had trademarked.
I have in my notes, meet Richard Rowe. Thank you, Frank Capra.
Yeah.
He is sentenced to 6 years at hard labor. Don't hit railroad bulls. And he goes off to the Paul Muni reference is apt here. He goes off to a prison work farm. I'm not quite sure how this thing is organized because there seems to be some profit motive for the guy who delivers him to the he gets paid for dropping him off. And then they're doing some sort of hard labor. Again, Joel McRae gets to take his shirt off and we get to see that. And this is the part of the movie that the export license was denied for because it's shorthand brutality. I mean, it's no fun by any means, but it's actually a fairly quick set of scenes where he is in this situation.
But he gets put in a sweatbox and you go, okay, well, it's not fun.
It's no fun. You know. He's working hard.
But yeah, ooh, shirtless.
So apparently,
I don't even swing that way. And he's, you know, still, it's Joel McRae. It's not bad.
They have some sort of relationship with this nearby church, apparently. Well, they don't say it's a church at the time, but apparently they're going to get to go see the movies on Saturday night. And Joel McRae, because he's been bad and he's in the sweatbox, doesn't necessarily get that privilege. But he's found a buddy already in the prison and at the work farm, and he gets fixed so that he is allowed to go. But we don't see that right away. What we see is an African-American church. And the minister of said church, Jess Lee Brooks, who, as I said before, was not even credited in the movie. You can find him in IMDb, but he was not credited in the film itself. He's leading the congregation, and he is actually admonishing them. He says, we have some people coming to join us. You need to not treat them badly. You need to. Yes, they're less fortunate than us, but we all need to be kind to them. We need not to show in any way any fear, any anger, any, you know, don't condescend to them, whatever. Now move and let them have the front three rows, and we're going to watch a movie. And as the prisoners come in, and this is handled very, very slowly, like the scene of the people in church before the prisoners come in, I think is perfectly paced. And then when the prisoners come in, time seems to slow down a lot, and the congregation is singing "Let My People Go," and it's really interesting. And it's definitely done in order to sort of slow us down and let us think about what's happening.
And that is totally. I mean, that scene alone, you could literally put it in the Coen Brothers film, and it would not be out of place.
Yeah, this was one of my favorite parts of the movie because I think after all of, like, I know that John L. Sullivan is our hero and we're supposed to, you know, be kind of like looking at the world through his eyes. And I had kind of gotten really sick of it by that time because, like David said, you know, handing out $5 bills is really patronizing and the whole idea of wanting to do the class tourism. And he hasn't really learned his lesson. It was making my shoulders sort of creep up to my ears a little bit. And then, but then we get this scene where we have a group of people who are simply kind, who are honestly kind of like Veronica Lake is at the beginning of the movie. Like their life situation is not necessarily all that great, but they are taking pity on people who are less fortunate than themselves and doing a kind thing for fellow human beings. And just the sort of the slowdown in the pace And the fact that we're watching something that can actually warm my heart as opposed to, you know, feeling a little bit saccharine or a little bit preachy, even though this was like the literally preachiest part of the movie, to me, it didn't feel preachy. It just felt nice and natural. And then that shot as they are as the men are sort of marching down with their chains down the aisle in the middle. And you've got the low camera angle, yes, like looking, you know, sort of through their legs. So you can really see those chains and watch them shuffle, you know, slowly. And sadly, like that was really affecting.
Well, and I think I know the distinction here, because for me, it doesn't feel preachy either. It feels human. Whereas a lot of the dialogue, like when the studio heads in the beginning are browbeating him about the different kinds of movies and the different kinds of writers and all this, and that's preachy. That's where he's, you know, hey, I'm going to hang a lampshade on every mention of the theme. Whereas this scene is just as it is. This scene could have played out anywhere, and he just happened to film it. Yeah. So it feels human to me. It doesn't feel preachy, even though it seems like it should.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a mistake that this is the most sincere part of the movie, because this is what the movie's been leading to. And it's Erica's mention of that low angle shot. I have it in my notes too. It's a wonderful shot, because not only you've got the tension of the prisoners coming up and you see their chains and they go off to different sides of the aisle into different pews. Then at the end of that, you've got the overseers with their shotguns that you see, mm-hmm. and then they part like opening curtains. And we're back to the preacher at the end, at the other end of the aisle, finishing off the song. And it is staged and shot so beautifully.
It's so well done.
That mm-hmm. it's lovely.
I do also have in my notes, everybody has a come to Pluto moment.
Indeed, because that's when we get the Disney cartoon, everybody laughs, the message of this scene and the movie is... everybody needs a laugh, especially people who are poor. So, but well done, yes. So in the meantime, while all this is happening to our hero, in quotes, if you like, he's been declared dead because they found the shoe in which there was a card identifying him. But the shoe was attached to somebody who was apparently dismembered by a train so badly that he cannot be identified.
It was the guy who rolled him.
Mm-hmm. It's the guy who rolled him. Who amazingly is also apparently the guy who stole his shoes at the mission.
Mm-hmm. Right, which is, I thought that was a weird...
Well, that's a little too much, but
I didn't think it was too much because he's the, like he, John L. Sullivan goes back to the same mission to like hand out $5 bills to the men that were around him at that time. Yeah. So he's going back to the same place. Also, this is the guy that saw him, sleeping and stole his shoes because they were in decent enough shape that they were better off than that guy's shoes. And, you know, maybe there's more than one person in that mission who would be willing to roll somebody for their money. But I kind of like the conservation of characters here in that we have one person who is the bad seed amongst this
one
group,
bad guy.
As opposed to
one
being multiple ones.
Yeah. And in terms of movie tropes and farce and Aristotelian unity, it makes sense. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, it works for me. So because he's been declared dead, that's all over the newspapers. And apparently at prison farms, they get fairly current newspapers because he sees...
Well, he sees the trustee.
I guess, right.
If you're Jim Conlon.
He sees that he's been declared dead, and he suddenly gets a great idea. I know how to get out of this. I'm going to confess.
Well, I have to get in the newspaper. That's what I have to do.
Right, I have to get into the newspaper.
How
I'm going to confess that I committed a murder. So that's the point at which the movie starts to just, in my opinion, kind of cave in on itself, and all the characters get brought back to where they were. And we need to wrap it up. It's been going too long. Let's end the movie now. And he and Veronica Lake end up together because his ex-wife, who was not his ex-wife, got married after he was declared dead. But now that he's alive, it would be bigamy. So she's going to want to get a divorce so that she can be married to the guy that she wants to be married to, which frees him to marry Veronica Lake. And this is the point also where he indicates, yeah, you know what? I think I'm just going to go back to making comedies. Ants in Your Plants of 1941, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, like I said, I like the message that we need joy and happiness and laughter in dark times. I don't like the way he resolves it for him.
Yeah, the idea that we need that's actually a drum that I have beat a whole bunch of times, that escapism is a good thing and it's something that we need, and creators should not be ashamed of making things that are just to make people laugh. So while I agree with sort of that premise, I'm very uncomfortable with the way it's presented in this movie. Yes. Because, you know, even specifically calling out Frank Capra and being like, you know, we're losing the fun because we've got too much of a message. And like, to me, that's like, you can have both. You don't necessarily need to sacrifice the one in order to have the other. And in this case, he does. And I totally agree, Shelley, with you that this character is not the right messenger for that message. Well, but it just doesn't feel like that comes across at the end to me. He doesn't say, I shouldn't do this because I'm not the one to tell this story. He says, people need to laugh. That's like, it comes out feeling like that's more important than anything else.
And it's a great thing that I can make people laugh. Ah. And then he thinks back to all the people laughing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And he and Veronica Lake are going to go live in his nice mansion and drive in that car and ride in the back of that limousine. And when she gives birth to her baby, you know, it'll be swaddled in $5 bills.
Yeah. But Sturgis did make a movie with a message. Mm-hmm. After saying that you shouldn't make, the theme of the movie is you shouldn't make movies with messages. He does make a movie with the message. And I think at one level, of course, the message of the movie is you shouldn't make movies with messages. But all of the internal part of the movie, the silent montage, and then I was a prisoner from a chain gang part of the movie, and the Black Church are all message parts. True. And they're the messages that are basically, oh, brother, where art thou messages. So Sturgis is having it both ways, and I think he wants to have it both ways.
I do, too. I think he's making – I mean, again, he's making fun of everyone's hypocrisy in this. I think he is making fun of the fact that, yeah, I'm just going to go make comedies. But he did make a message picture.
Yeah, and the movie does have heart, and the message of the movie is not simply – shut up and just make funny movies.
Right.
Because he didn't. Because although he did make a movie that's very funny, this movie does show the things that Sullivan wanted to show.
And he's really uncomfortable, Sturgis, I mean, with the idea of message pictures in the sense of them being on the nose, which is what a Capra, that the biggest criticism of a Capra picture is that it's so on the nose and it so hits you over the head.
That's why I hate Capra.
Right. And that's what... That's what Sturgis is cautioning against, and that the solution for his character is go back and make comedies is sort of unsatisfying. But again, that's a movie trope. What you want as a movie viewer often is for the character to learn the right lesson and to take action on that basis.
Right.
But that's not what he wants this character to do, because Sturgis thinks that's too much on the nose.
And he name checks Capper, and he name checks Lubitsch. Yep. And Lubitsch pictures were romantic, funny, could be very, very funny, but did also have a message, too. They did have a brain to them. They weren't just slapstick Keystone Cops, you know.
I do think the politics is interesting. And again, like, and Capra was a conservative in the sense of the word at that time, that was more about a sort of a traditional patriotism and rah-rah America, but that had less to do with... He was something of a reactionary personally, but his movies were not really reactionary movies. Sturgis is also uncomfortable with the sort of limousine liberal trope. He's really, that's what Sturgis is. That's what Sullivan is. He's this guy who wants to do good, but has no clue how to do it. And so Sturgis, as you say, is goring all the oxes, and he's not saying, I'm coming down on the Capra side or the FDR side or whatever known political side there might be. I think if you tried to put him in a box politically, he'd probably be pretty unhappy with that.
Yeah, I don't think he's not in any in the actions of the people in the studio heads or Sullivan. He's not telling us how to make a movie about poor people. He made a movie about poor people.
Right.
And it's not mainly about poor people. Certainly none of the main characters, none of the stock company, Joel McRae, Veronica Lake, despite her being sort of down on her luck a little bit at the beginning, none of those people are the people that ultimately you should be sympathetic with in this movie. It's the people in the church and the people in the mission that you should feel sympathetic to. And it's by not hitting us over the head with that, I think, that he makes a good movie about it.
And the twist of using the black church as the people who are impoverished but who have more than the other characters have. I mean, the preacher as a character is far more fleshed out than even the people at the mission. There's very little dialogue amongst the people that he encounters.
Yeah.
Most of them don't even talk to him.
Yeah, they don't get lines.
Yes, but it's a great sort of twist of Sturgis to say, you know what, I'm going to essentially make my heroes or the examples I want people to follow this church full of God-fearing people that's making room for not only hobos, but they're prisoners. So it's not just people
criminals.
Down on their luck, but people, yes, they're criminals. Well, Preston Sturgis, some of us liked it maybe a little better than others. Erica, you had some concerns, some quibbles, some misgivings. How did you come down on it overall?
I still like it. I still think it's a good movie. I don't think it delivers on the message as well as some of the rest of you seem to think. I have trouble with the end of a movie where the rich people get to go back to being as rich as they are. Like, his choice to make a sad movie or a happy movie is kind of beside the point. That's not the bit that makes me super uncomfortable. It's sort of that he really, in the end, the only thing that he learns is about himself. It's a very self-centered picture when it comes to his character. So I'm left feeling very... when you're watching a Frank Capra picture and it's super on the nose and like, you know, that's on sort of one end of the spectrum. I feel like this errs on the other side of hitting it just right, because I'm just still left feeling really icky and bad for maybe that montage was too effective for me, because I feel like these people are in terrible straits and a few of them get a $5 bill. And in the end, the guy who went to see all of this goes back to his giant mansion with his pool, and he gets the girl and he gets to make pictures that are going to make him lots and lots and lots more money. And there's no hint that he is actually going to do anything besides make those people laugh. And that's the bit that I cannot get past emotionally. So I don't think I'll be revisiting this picture an awful lot in the future, but you know, I can see myself rewatching it at some point.
Where does it land for any of you in the Preston Sturgis pantheon? If you've seen other, I think David, you were talking a little bit about Lady Eve and Palm Beach Story, which I really love.
Palm Beach Story and Lady Eve are probably my favorite of his movies. And then there's like that second tier where you have, I'm blanking, The Miracle of Morgan's Creek and Great McGinty and Sullivan's Travels. And I would put Sullivan's Travels at the low end of that second tier. And again, you know, how much of it changed in the filming? How much of it changed from the personalities? We don't know. We don't know. It's an odd film in his group. And then you have the rest of his movies, like the, what's that Betty Grable one? Oh, I'm blanking on that.
It's not coming to me either.
And then Unfaithfully Yours, which is a little dark and not in a good way. It's kind of lower second tier for me. Whereas Lady, and when I say second tier, that first tier is so far above the second tier. It's like those are two of my favorite films of all time. So this is another film he made. It sounds like a Preston Sturgis film. It does everything it says on the box. It's fine.
Dr. Drang, what's your how do you come down on it ultimately?
Well, I come down on it as this is possibly not my favorite Preston Sturgis movie, but it and The Palm Beach Story are my favorite Preston Sturgis movies. And I like it because maybe because it's a mess. Maybe because it jerks you back and forth.
Sure.
I can't help but that opening scene, to me, That is one of the greatest opening scenes of any movie, any comedy movie anyway. It is so sparkling. It is so good, and it is so well acted and well delivered and well written. And then as you go along, in some respects, the rest of the movie kind of doesn't live up to how good that scene is. But I think the rest of the movie is still very good. It's just that one that is so outstanding there. I really love the fact that it moves back and forth. And, you know, I don't like the slapsticky parts because I'm not a big fan of slapstick. And I do wish the chase scene didn't go on as long as it did. I could do without William Demarest's slow burn routine. I've never really thought he was that good at that, although apparently he thought he was very good at it, and other people did, because they kept having him, they had him do that in lots of movies. I think he does some good things in here, but not that. Gosh, Eric Blore and Robert Gregg are so good in this, and Franklin Pangborn is exceptional, even though he's not playing a maitre d'.
That's why I liked him in this. He's not doing his usual shtick.
He's a little bit out of what he, and Porter Hall I love in almost everything he does. So I'm, and Joel McRae, who I tend to think of as sort of a second tier cowboy guy, like the guy you do if John Wayne doesn't want to do the movie. He's very good in this.
Oh yeah.
I think his sneezes are pretty good.
Mm-hmm. His sneezes are great.
Yeah, yeah.
He's really, I think, excellent in this movie. Veronica Lake is
also present
in the movie.
Pretty better than you might think.
Yeah.
I thought she was fine.
It's kind of like she gets better as she goes along. I don't know that they shot it in sequence. They probably didn't.
Probably not.
But I just sort of had the feeling, because the first scene she's in, she's not really that great. Even like the dialogue in the diner is really good, and she delivers some of her lines well, but I don't look at her and go, well, that's a good little actress.
Right.
Right there.
I mean, he was apparently considering Barbara Stanwyck for it. And I love Barbara Stanwyck when she's good. And she would have been too sharp for this. She would have been
too much for it.
As she is in every movie.
Yeah.
But it works in The Lady Eve.
How can you imagine Joel McRae falling in love with Barbara Stanwyck?
I can't. That's
or indeed anyone falling in love with Barbara Stanwyck.
Oh my goodness.
I can imagine Henry Fonda, but I was never a fan of Henry Fonda.
Joel McRae and Barbara Stanwyck made several movies together and managed to fall in love a couple times. So No, Palm Beach Story is the one where I think Joel McRae really outdoes himself.
Yes.
He's fine in this. He is up to the challenge and is pretty good. But in Palm Beach Story, you go, wow, I didn't know he could do that.
It's exponential.
Because he's so funny.
And I mean, one of the writers that kind of taught me how to write the way I like to write was Preston Sturges. And so I do love the opening scene, even though, I mean, it has a couple of little bobbles here and there, but, you know, it's so beautifully staged and just rapid fire. I love good rapid fire writing. And the rest of the movie doesn't quite have that kind of writing, but the Palm Beach Story does. And it's almost as though he looked at that and said, wow, Joel was able to handle that. Let's do this. Yeah. And that just never stops. It's
so interesting because Joel McRae had, in the 30s, he did fewer Westerns than he went on to do later. He was doing some, but in the early 30s, he was doing sort of young leading man stuff. And then he did these movies in the early 40s. But he really liked doing Westerns. And so he just went back to doing that. And so I've seen probably a handful of his movies because I don't really want to watch Westerns. Although, if given a choice between John Wayne and Joel McRae, I'd watch Joel McRae because he's very surly. Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, dear Lord.
except for the Cavalry trilogy, I really don't like John Wayne movies.
I only like them when I'm sitting in the living room with a friend who decided we were going to have John Wayne weekend and we're going to eat meat and potatoes and watch nothing but John Wayne movies.
Oh,
ironically, that was fun.
I could do that.
Maybe.
I wouldn't do that even for irony.
Yeah, I'm with you, Dr. Drang. I feel like that sounds like
torture.
I
would be focusing on the potatoes.
Yes, potatoes, and there was beer also.
And see, beer and donuts.
Well, yes,
I mean, it made it worthwhile.
If you can get so completely plots that you that you're not bothering to watch the movie, right. then I'm okay with it.
I think that might have been the secret of it, and yelling at the screen was okay because nobody was really paying attention. It was a really fun weekend. Well, we've gone away by my leading. We've gone away from Sullivan's Travels, but that's fine. Speaking of which, we'll be back in 2 weeks with a very different movie. It is a crossover with our friends at Agents of Smooch. We watched Two for the Road, Audrey Hepburn and Albert Finney from 1967. So if you want to hear what we think of comedies in the 60s, please stay tuned for that show episode, which will also be available on Agents of Smooch, a delightful podcast that I recommend you all listen to. And now, before we go, I want to thank my guests and give them an opportunity to plug the things they're doing on the internet. David, since you're our first timer, why don't you go first? Where can people find you?
They can find me on Entirely Too Many Incomparable Series and at davidjlore.com. And I'm putting together a mini series from the world of the Incomparable Radio Theater right now. So stay tuned.
I can't wait to hear it. And Dr. Drang, how about you?
You can read my infrequent blog at leancrew.com, LEANCREW. And I show up occasionally on The Incomparable. I was on an episode of The Automators podcast, not anything like what this podcast is, when this one comes out, it will be a couple weeks ago.
And Erica, thanks for coming back for Message Picture Corner.
Yeah.
Nice to have you.
it's my jam. I can be found on Twitter at HollyGoDarkly. And I can also be found all over the Incomparable Network. I am an agent of Smooch. I appear on that podcast occasionally. And I may have a little something to do with that miniseries that David just mentioned. And
a little bit.
A little bit. And I also do Lazy Doctor Who on the Incomparable Network. And Beginner's Puck, which is all about hockey, which is apparently coming back at this point. as this episode comes out, hockey will be coming back very shortly. So probably expect to hear me talking about that.
Hockey in the summertime.
Yeah,
it is
truly the end times. Things are weird, no. But I live in Edmonton. It's happening in my city, so I'm a little excited.
How do they do it outdoors in the summer?
Canada's very cold, David.
I've heard that. Well, you can subscribe to this show if you haven't for some reason at theincomparable.com/LTS. You can also follow us over on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, no plurals because of character limits. Or if you want to harass me personally on Twitter, don't harass me. Don't at me. you can do that at Shelley, Shelly. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Two for the Road. Bye now.